Hi, Allison.
Hi, Max.
Did you get your stickers?
I did.
Yes. How did you get yours?
I got my stickers because I want to be part of the Sticker of the Month Club. I went to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor and became a supporter for $5 a podcast.
Yes, fantastic. Do you know how else you can get the stickers?
I bought some for my grandmother.
Fantastic.
At umpboh.com.
Fantastic. All right. So go get your stickers.
Hi, guys.
Hello, and welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking about Zaha Hadid.
This week, I'm talking about Mata Hari.
Yes.
Get pumped. Mata Hari. She was born Margarita Gertrida Zell McLeod on August 7th, 1876 in the Netherlands. She was the eldest of four children. Her father owned a hat shop and had a bunch of mad successful investments in the oil industry. And so she lived a very lavish childhood. She has no Asian or Middle Eastern ancestry at all. Her parents are both Dutch.
Interesting.
You just go with it.
Sure.
Her father went bankrupt in 1889. Her parents divorced. Her mother passed away. Her father remarried. All of these things going down. So she studied to be a kindergarten teacher. But when the headmaster was caught conspicuously flirting with her, she was removed from the institution by her godfather. So she fled to her uncle's home in The Hague at the capital province of South Holland.
Mm-hmm.
When she was 18, she answered an ad in a Dutch newspaper placed by the Dutch Colonel Army Captain Rudolf McLeod, who was then living in the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia. Mm-hmm. He was looking for a wife. They were 21 years apart in age, but they got married on July 11th, and it put her in the Dutch upper class and gave her financial stability.
Great.
They had two children together. But the marriage was still a disappointment because McLeod was an alcoholic. He beat her on a regular basis. He blamed her for his lack of promotion in the army. He openly kept a concubine. So she left him briefly, moving in with another Dutch officer. But despite her marriage, she began to study Indonesians' traditions intensively, and she joined a local dance company. So then she revealed in 1897 her artistic name, Mata Hari, which means sun. In 1899, both of their children fell severely ill while being treated for syphilis, and their son actually passed away.
Aye.
Both Mata Hari and her husband believe that the children were poisoned by an angry servant or one of McLeod's enemies. Mm. So they moved back to the Netherlands and they officially separated in 1902. Margarita Mata Hari was awarded custody of their daughter,
mm-hmm.
but McLeod never paid his child support, which made their lives very difficult, of course. So she eventually had to give up custody because she didn't have any family connections and her work options were limited.
Yeah.
And their daughter also later died at the age of 21, also possibly from complications to syphilis. So guys, come on, use a condom.
Right.
I mean, I don't think that was an option for them at the time. I'm just saying, PSA. In 1903, she moved to Paris and she began to perform as a circus horse rider under the name Lady McLeod, much to the chagrin of her ex-family, of course. She also posed as an artist model. In 1905, she began to win fame as an exotic dancer under the name Mata Hari, where she was a contemporary of other famous dancers like Isadora Duncan.
Whoa.
And she was kind of part of this, being around these leaders in the early modern dance movement. She was an overnight success from her debut of her act at the Musée Guimet on March 13th. After this debut, she became the longtime mistress of the millionaire lion industrialist Emile Etienne Guimet, who had founded the musée where she was performing.
Right.
So she posed as a princess of priestly Hindu birth, pretending to have been immersed in the art of sacred Indian dance since childhood. Again, she's completely Dutch.
Right.
She brought a carefree, provocative style to the stage in her act, which garnered her wide acclaim. The most celebrated and famous segment of her act was when she would progressively shed her clothing until all she wore was a jeweled bra and ornaments upon her arms and head.
Amazing.
So her act was so successful, it elevated exotic dance to a more respectable status and broke new ground in entertainment styles in Paris. And she mingled in wealthy circles. Since most of the Europeans were unfamiliar with the Dutch East Indies, no one questioned her backstory.
Right.
By 1910, there were so many Mata Hari imitators, and critics began to say that the success in her act was due to just cheap exhibition and it lacked any real artistic merit.
Mm-hmm.
So her career began to go into decline in 1912. She performed her last show in 1915 as a dancer. And then World War I started.
Yeah.
The Netherlands remained neutral during the war, and as a Dutch subject, Mata Hari was able to cross national borders freely. So she traveled between France and the Netherlands via Spain and Britain, and her movements attracted attention. She became involved in a very intense relationship with a Russian pilot, Captain Vadim Maslov, oh, who was serving the French, whom she called the love of her life.
Oh.
In the summer of 1916, Maslov was shot down and badly wounded, losing sight in both of his eyes. So Mata Hari asked permission to visit him at the hospital where he was staying near the front. And as a citizen of a neutral country, she would not normally be allowed near the front. So she was met by agents who told her she could go see him if she agreed to spy on Germany. So she met, one of the people that she met with was an army captain, Georges Ladoux. And she said, okay, things are about to get crazy.
Right.
So in November 1916, she's traveling by steamer from Spain when her ship called at the British port of Falmouth. She was there arrested and brought to London, where she was interrogated by a commissioner in charge of counter-espionage.
Oh, my God.
There she told him of France's deal to her in regards to spying on the Germans.
Right.
The French would not admit to this, but it's unclear if that's because she lied or they were too embarrassed.
Like, right.
We would never ask that. Eventually, she was released. In
right.
1916, then she traveled to Madrid and met with the German military attaché, Major Arnold Kell, and asked if he could arrange a meeting for her with the Crown Prince.
Oh.
So she apparently offered to share French secrets with Germany in exchange for money, and her motivations to do so remains kind of unclear.
Right.
Whether it was greed or she thought it would help her get a meeting with Prince Wilhelm.
Right.
Don't really know. In January 1917, this German major, Major Kahl, transmitted radio messages to Berlin describing the helpful activities of a German spy, codenamed H-21, whose description matches Mata Hari's.
Ooh.
So the French Bureau intercepts this message and identified her as H-21.
Oh, no.
These messages were in a code that the Germans knew had already been broken by the French, which means that the Germans purposefully did this to have her arrested by the French.
Oh, God.
So an intelligence officer of the German army had apparently grown very annoyed that Mata Hari could provide no actual useful intelligence on the French, but instead just pass Paris gossip about sex lives of French politicians and generals. So he decided to expose her as a German spy. So to incriminate her even further, the French Bureau gave Mata Hari the names of 6 Belgian agents, 5 of whom were suspected of submitting fake material and working for the Germans, and 1 who was suspected of being a double agent for the Germans and French.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 weeks after, Mata Hari left for a trip to Madrid and the double agent was executed by the Germans.
Oh.
This served as proof that she gave the names of the 6 spies to the Germans.
Yeah.
So she's getting played from all sides.
Yes, she is.
On February 13th, 1917, Mata Hari was arrested in her room at the Hotel Elysee Palace on the Champs-Élysées in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
She was put on trial on July 24th, accused of spying for Germany and causing the deaths of 20,000 to 50,000 soldiers. Neither French nor British intelligence could produce definite evidence against her.
Of course
but they supposedly found secret ink in her room, which she claimed was part of her makeup. So who knows?
Okay.
During her trial, she was interrogated about her true origins, which was when she was revealed to just be Dutch.
Right.
And this was used to show that she was dishonest.
Right.
So she admitted that she had accepted 20,000 francs from a German diplomat to spy on France, but insisted she only passed on trivial information. Captain Georges Ladoux, the man who had asked her to spy in the first place, helped to bring her downfall, stepping forward as her most forthright accuser and making sure that the evidence against her was constructed in a damning way.
Right.
He apparently even tampered with some of the evidence to implicate her more deeply than the actual truth. So she wrote letters to the Dutch ambassador in Paris claiming her innocence. She wrote, quote, "My international connections are due of my work as a dancer, nothing else, because I really did not spy. It is terrible that I cannot defend myself," end quote. The worst came when her lover, Maslov, refused to testify for her and told her he couldn't care if she was convicted or not.
Wow. Jeez, dude.
The main prosecutor used the fact that she was a woman as evidence of her guilt. Quote, without scruples, accustomed to make use of men, she is the type of woman who was born to spy.
Oh, end Jesus.
Quote. So she was sentenced to death by firing squad. She was executed on October 15th, 1917 at the age of 41. She was not tied to the stake and refused a blindfold.
Of course.
Before she was shot, she blew a kiss to the firing squad.
Oh my God.
Which is basically the most giant F you can even imagine.
She could just raise both middle fingers.
And then like, bring it, bitches. In October 2001, documents were released from the archives of MI5, you know, basically,
sure. British intelligence.
British CIA, mm-hmm. which proved that she was not guilty of the charges she was convicted of. A spokesman from the Mata Hari Foundation argued that she was simply a low-level spy who provided no secrets to either side, stating, quote, we believe that there are sufficient doubts concerning the dossier of information that was used to convict her to warrant reopening the case. Maybe she wasn't entirely innocent, but it seems clear she wasn't the master spy whose right. information sent thousands of soldiers to their right. deaths as has been claimed, end quote. Her body was not claimed by any family members and was used for medical study, which is cool. I want my body to be used for medical study, but it's not cool that your family right. doesn't come and try right. and claim your body. Her head was embalmed and kept in the Museum of Anatomy in Paris. In 2000, it was discovered that it had disappeared and it remains missing to this day.
What?
All documents related to her trial and conviction are scheduled to be declassified this year, 100 years after her execution.
Oh my God. Lanta.
I am waiting for this biography on pens and needles.
Wait, where's her head?
Since the centenary of her execution is approaching, there is renowned interest in her story. A novel was recently released based on her called The Spy, and a ballet was created based on her at the Royal Dutch Ballet. And so we'll just see what these documents say when they come out.
I want to know where her head is. Who has her head?
Who
stole Mata Hari's head?
Nuts. Totally nuts. Wow. What a life.
Wow.
What a life.
What a life. Caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, but kind of put herself in that place at the same time. Well, thank
Blowing
you for her story.
Blowing a kiss to the firing squad. Okay, I'm ready.
All right. So Zaha Hadid,
mm-hmm.
She is considered by many to be one of the greatest female architects of the modern world. No, excuse me. She is considered to be the greatest female architect of the modern world. And she is also a dame of the British Empire.
Ooh.
So it's Dame Zaha Hadid. She was born on October 31st, 1950 in Baghdad, in Iraq. Her father was a wealthy industrialist from Mosul and the co-founder of the left-liberal Al-Ahali group in 1932. This was a significant political organization in the 30s and 40s, and he was also the co-founder of the National Democratic Party in Iraq and served as the Minister of Finance in the late 50s. Her mother's name was Wajiha Al-Sabunji, and she was an artist from Mosul. Mm. In the 60s, she attended boarding schools in England and Switzerland. She studied mathematics at the American University in Beirut. And then in 1972, she moved to London to study at the Architectural Association School of Architecture.
Mm.
The Architectural Association School of Architecture. She studied with successful architects in their own right, including Rem Koolhaas, Elia Zengelis, and Bernard Sakumi. Elia Zengelis described her as the most outstanding pupil he had ever taught. Quote,
wow.
We called her the inventor of the 89 degrees. Nothing was ever at 90 degrees. She had spectacular vision. All the buildings were exploding into tiny little pieces. After her graduation in 1977, she went to work for her former professors Koolhaas and Zengelis at the Office for Metropolitan Architecture in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. She became a naturalized citizen of the United Kingdom, and she opened her architectural firm in London in 1980 called Zaha Hadid Architects. She then began teaching architecture at a variety of schools. So she taught at the Architectural Association, where she'd gone to school, Harvard Graduate School of Design, Cambridge, the University of Chicago, the Hochschule für Bildende Künste in Hamburg, Germany. I'm sure I just murdered that German. The University of Illinois at Chicago, and also at Columbia University.
Holy bucket.
Right? She earned a reputation with her lecturing and the colorful and radical designs and projects that she presented. These were widely published in architectural journals, but remain largely unbuilt. Now, these projects included a plan for Peak Club in Hong Kong and the Opera in Cardiff, Wales. And she actually won a competition by jury for the Opera in Cardiff, but the Welsh government refused to pay for it. So they gave the commission to a different and less ambitious architect. Mm. Well, her international reputation greatly increased in 1988 when she was chosen to show her drawings and paintings as one of seven architects to participate in an exhibition called Deconstructivism in Architecture at New York's Museum of Modern Art.
Mm.
Her building started to get built in the 90s, and one of her first was for Rolf Felbaum, who was the president and director of the German furniture firm Vitra. In 1989, he'd invited Frank Gehry, who is a very famous LA-based architect, to build a design museum at the Vitra factory in Wal am Rhein, Germany. In 1993, he invited Zaha to build a fire station for that same factory. The design was radical, made of raw concrete and glass and composed of sharp diagonal forms that collided together at the center. It appeared in architecture magazines before it was ever constructed.
Whoa.
However, when it was completed, it couldn't serve as a fire station because the government regulations for industrial firefighting had changed. But it did become an exhibit space instead and is now on display with the works of Gehry and other well-known architects.
Wow.
This building, many believe, served as the launching pad for her very, very successful career.
Hmm.
So a rundown of her other kind of beginning projects kind of laid the foundation. She built a public housing estate in Berlin between 86 and 93, the Great Utopia exhibition at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, a sky jump at Bergisel in Austria that would be used for international competitions. At the end of the 90s, she won commissions for two museums and a large industrial building. She competed against former teacher Rem Koolhaas for the design of the Contemporary Arts Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. And she won, which made her the first woman to design an art museum in the United States.
Whoa!
The New York Times declared this building the most important American building to be completed since the end of the Cold War.
Wow.
In 2000, she won an international competition for the Fano Science Center in Wolfsburg, Germany, which was completed in 2005. And the museum structure resembles an enormous ship with sloping walls and asymmetric scatterings of windows. We're going to put pictures of all of these on our Instagram. And then in 2002, she won another competition to design the new administrative building for BMW in Leipzig, Germany. In 2004... Zaha won the Pritzker Architecture Prize, the most prestigious award in architecture, even though at this point she'd only completed four buildings.
Wow.
In making the announcement, Thomas Pritzker, the head of the jury, announced, "Although her body of work is relatively small, she has achieved great acclaim and her energy and ideas show even greater promise for the future." She was the first woman to win this prize.
Snaps, snaps, snaps.
One of her most famous structures that was built actually for the Olympics in London was the Aquatic Center.
Okay.
She built that. And it's very curvy and very wavy. Yeah. She built the Gangju Opera House in China, which she won an international competition for it to be built.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually two buildings. It covers 70,000 square meters.
Whoa.
And was built at a cost of $300 million. It has an 1,800 seat theater.
Wow.
Included with another multi-purpose theater, an entry hall and a salon, as well as covered pathways with restaurants and shops. And it was used as the center of a new business district that was noted by critics that it would transform the urban landscape of Guangzhou and was also called a Chinese gem that elevates its setting. So this is her. I mean, we're going to post a lot more pictures.
I want to see all these pictures.
They're all absolutely gorgeous. They're all curvy and wavy and beautiful.
Oy.
On March 31st in 2016, Zaha died of a heart attack in a Miami hospital where she was being treated for bronchitis.
Whoa!
Her London design studio issued the following statement. Zaha Hadid was widely regarded to be the greatest female architect in the world today. Following her death, Michael Kimmelman of the New York Times wrote, Hadid embodied in its profligacy and promise the era of so-called architects who roamed the planet in pursuit of their own creative genius, offering miracles and occasionally delivering. Diane Sujic of The Guardian said that Hadid was an architect who first imagined, then proved that space could work in radical ways. Throughout her career, she was a dedicated teacher, enthused by the energy of the young. She was not keen to be characterized as a woman architect or an Arab architect. She was simply an architect. And then a final quote from Hadid. She said, I never use the issue about being a woman architect, but if it helps younger people to know that they can break through the glass ceiling, I don't mind that. A list of her awards and honors. It's long. The Gold Medal Architectural Design in 1982. Eric Schelling Architectural Award in 1994. Austrian Decoration for Science Art in 2005. German Architectural Park for the Central Building of BMW Plant in 2005. Designer of the Year Award in Miami in 2005. Reba European Award in 2005 and 2006. The Thomas Jefferson Medal for Architecture in 2007. The Reba European Award in 2008. She was ranked 69th in the Forbes list of the world's 100 most powerful women in 2008. The Reba European Award in 2010, the Sterling Prize in 2010. She was named an influential thinker in Times 100 issue in 2010.
Wow.
The Jane Drew Prize for her outstanding contribution to the status of women in architecture in 2012. She was a jury member for the awarding of the Pritzker Prize in 2012. She was listed as one of the 100 most powerful women in the UK by BBC Radio 4 in 2013. 41st winner of the Vevu Cliqua UK Business Woman Award in 2013, elected international member American Philosophical Society in 2013. She was on the editorial board of the Encyclopedia Britannica in 2014. Oh, she won Design Museum Design of the Year Award for the Haider Aliyev Cultural Center, making her the first woman to win the prize, again in 2014. She had a square in Antwerp, Belgium named after her in 2016. And she had a Google Doodle for her on May 31st, 2017 to commemorate the date on which Hadid became the first woman to win the Pritzker Prize in architecture.
Amazing. Amazing.
One of the most influential builders the world has known.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing that one. The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can download a free book and start your free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
This week, check out The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers by Elizabeth Cobbs. It's the story of how America's first women soldiers helped win World War I, earned the vote, and fought the U.S. Army. In 1918, the U.S. Army Signal Corps sent 223 women to France, and they were the masters of this latest technology, the telephone switchboard.
Yes.
General John Pershing, commander of the American Expeditionary Forces, demanded female, quote, wire experts when he discovered that inexperienced doughboys were unable to keep him connected with troops under fire. I can't wait for this. I'm so excited.
That sounds amazing.
So that is The Hello Girls by Elizabeth Cobbs. You can get that at audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Yes, ma'am. Hey, friends. If you're enjoying The Bitchery of History, do us a favor and go to Podomatic, Stitcher, Google Play Music, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening to, and all the places you're not listening to us, and leave us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find this podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks.
Today in history?
Yes, ma'am.
On July 16th, 1971, Jeannie M. Holm is promoted to Brigadier General in the United States Air Force, becoming the first woman of that rank in the Air Force.
Yes. And then on July 18th, 1976, Nadia Comaneci becomes the first person in Olympic Games history to score a perfect 10 in gymnastics at the 1976 Summer Games.
Nadia Comaneci was one of my heroes.
Yes.
July 21st, 1960s, Sirimavo Bandaranaike took office as the Prime Minister of Ceylon, becoming the first female Prime Minister of the modern world. You can hear more about her on Season 1, Episode 26, The Mythic Queen and the Prime Minister.
Yes. All right. So, term of the week.
Yes, please.
Kind of building off of the conversation we had last week, I thought we would talk about bad feminism. And this this term comes from a book called Bad Feminist by Roxane Gay. And the conversation we had last week was all about how feminism has excluded people to push forward agendas.
Right.
And I thought this week we would talk about ways to accept that people are people when they make mistakes. Mm. And I guess ways that we have found that work in our own lives that have helped us to kind of accept our mistakes and move forward from them. So, for example, Roxane Gay talks in Bad Feminist about how the people feel bad about the fact that they don't fit into what people think a feminist should be or to look like, and they feel bad about that because it doesn't feel like that it includes them. And kind of building off our last thing, I think it's taking feminism and molding it to fit what you are, and then being the feminists we wish to see moving through the world. So I was just wondering, when you've come across instances where you have maybe accidentally talked about something from a point of privilege or talked about something from a point of your own racial kind of blind spots, how you've then spurred a conversation of, oh, that's interesting. What is your take on that? Or what do you think about that?
For me, really, the answer isn't so much a specific instance that I can think of, which is maybe fortunate, maybe unfortunate. Maybe I need to be more aware of the conversations that I'm having or what I'm putting out in the world. But a struggle that I had recently was I felt that I had done some things that I needed to, that I should apologize for. And they weren't bad things. It was just, oh, I kind of stepped on that person's toes during a meeting or a discussion, and I maybe should have let them finish their thought a little bit and not been so eager to jump on board and be myself and just like start talking about a thousand things. And then I kind of had this internal struggle of, well, do I apologize for that? Because women are kind of told now to not apologize because it's weak. But if I do feel that I've done something wrong, isn't it strong to apologize and admit that I made a mistake? But I don't want to be that person that's just going around and apologizing for things that don't need an apology. Right. And I was just going around and around and around. And I finally decided, no, if I think that I have made a mistake, whether that's in coming from a place of privilege or simply speaking over someone in a discussion or putting something out there about a project that I didn't have the greatest experience on, but I can't speak to everyone's experience. Right. So that doesn't mean it was a bad project. It just means it was very stressful for me or whatever the case may be.
Right.
There is strength in owning up to that mistake and reaching out to someone and just saying, hey, I just want to make sure, you know, we're cool with what I said, and I apologize for that, and I'm really proud of all the work that we did together, whatever the case may be. So I think that is more where I come from is, yes, I think it's weak to apologize when it's unnecessary, but when it's necessary, it takes a lot of strength to go up to someone and own up to those mistakes in whatever the circumstance might be.
I had a professor at UNCG, you know Lorraine. So she was always very adamant about nobody ever apologizing unless you absolutely had to. And I kind of agree with you where there is a strength in having your apology mean something by not apologizing all the time.
Right.
And I think that honestly, I have found that people respect my apologies more because I'm not quick to offer my apologies. And that's really because I try not to do anything that requires an apology in terms of my actions or my speech, which I have to believe that no one ever does anything that they deliberately think they're going to have to apologize for. That might be a little pie in the sky, but
they just don't think they have to apologize for it.
That too. She would say instead, instead of apologizing, take responsibility for your actions and find a way to move on from it.
Yeah.
Because if you're apologizing for everything, and I say this to my friends all the time, And I'll look at them and I'll say, stop apologizing. Mm-hmm. You don't have anything to apologize for. And I think a lot of times people will apologize before they say something that they wholeheartedly believe.
Yeah.
Or they'll apologize for a thought or an idea that they have come to through some mental gymnastics of their own.
Right.
Which is admirable. But if it's come to the wrong conclusion, I don't think you should apologize for that. I mean, if it's a thought out thing that you came to, mm-hmm. I think you should take responsibility for your thoughts and say, okay, let's grow from this. How can I take the gymnastics and what equation did I put wrong, or like, did I put a plus or a minus? You know what I mean?
Right.
I have found the example I was thinking of is the mislabeling of people in the trans community. And I know I talked about this last week as well, where people get into apologizing profusely when they accidentally mislabel somebody. Like if someone desires for pronouns to be used for them or he and him, for example, and you accidentally use she or her, instead of saying, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, just say, oh, he, and just move on from the conversation.
Right. Yeah.
And that is a way to acknowledge the mistake or the slip and to continue the conversation. Because I think at a certain point, especially with topics like feminism that are so multifaceted and sometimes so contentious, I think you end up making the other person feel awkward, or you end up making the other person feel like they can't have a full conversation with you because you are so wrapped up in the fact that you think that they are worried about you.
Right.
You know, every word that you have to say. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's great.
So move on.
Move on to our cause of the week.
Yes, ma'am.
We've got Women on Wings. They are at womenonwings.com. They aim to co-create 1 million jobs for women in rural India. A job, of course, means income, economic autonomy, and an escape from the cycle of poverty. So their vision is, in order to reach our goal, we share business knowledge with social entrepreneurs in India that work with rural women to accelerate the growth of their organizations. Their core values are living up to what we do, what we say, and we are specific. Equality, we work on the basis of equality and with respect for people. And energetic, people show enthusiasm, courage, and energy for the heart of the matter.
Yeah.
So look into them. They're a cool organization.
Absolutely.
womenonwings.com.
Fantastic. The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions. You can find us on all of your social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just search The Bitchery of History or search our handle, UMPBOH.
You can always find our website, UMPBOH.com, as well.
Yes. Look for that new shop where you can buy our stickers. Fulan Devi is our first.
We cannot make this podcast happen without our amazing production team. Jeanette,
Kim,
Steph,
Sydney,
Dan,
Jess,
Keegan, and Olivia.
If you would like to help us make this podcast happen, join that Sticker of the Month Club and get exclusive behind-the-scenes access to the Patreon blog, patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.